What's up and welcome to Hello from Bhutan. I am Namgizam. Today, the theme for this podcast is Women in Governance, a Transcontinental Dialogue. This podcast is brought to you by the Friedrich Naumann Foundation. Joining me in this very delightful conversation is the Honourable Member of the German National Parliament, MP Sandra Wieser. Thank you for coming on this podcast.
I'm delighted to be here.
We also have Amphan Sokchodin, who is a leader in all things gender. She's a gender specialist and a consultant. She's worked and has extensive experience working with women in entrepreneurship as well as in governance. I'm so glad to have you on the podcast as well, Lam. It's nice to see you again after a long time. So I'm so glad to be speaking to the two of you today. I would like to begin by asking MP Sandra to take us through your journey in politics. I mean, you've been in politics for well over a decade. What's kept you at it and what's kept you in it for so long?
But actually, who got me in there is a man. Yeah, I was the economic minister in my federal state of Rhineland-Palatinate. And he was the guy who said, hey, Mrs. Wieser, you have to come into the FDP, the Liberal Party. And I don't know, I renounced a couple of months. And there was another meeting because I'm from a family business. And so he had to do a lot with organizations, with companies and so on. And then I met him once again, and when I came out of this meeting, I signed my belonging to the party. And since then, I'm part of the Liberal Party, but I never regret it.
Did you ever grow up thinking that you would be where you are today, or did you have like other aspirations?
Never ever, even 10 years ago, because when I engaged in this party, I thought to do this really on a community level and go in organizations, yeah, like something like this. But that I will be part of the German parliament, never ever I thought this, no. It was, I don't know, it just happened somehow. But to insist to be there at the right time in the right place, I think this is also... doing the right things, exactly, yeah.
So what has changed in German politics? I mean, you've been in it for so long, right? I'm sure you've seen how it's evolved over the time. So how was it when you started? Has it changed so much from then, or...?
Yeah, it's starting. It already changed, but it has also to change still a lot, I think. When I started there was still this, I don't know if it's here the same in Bhutan, but the parties, they get their meetings in the evening, somewhere in a bar behind, in a room, a bar pub, I would say, not in a bar. Not table dancing or whatever, no. No, that you're in a pub, in a common big room where we can meet with 10 to 25 people. And then you're, as a woman, you're looking on your watch and you say, okay, the children, they want to go to bed. You have to do plenty of things. You also have a job. And that's, I think this is one of the big things why women don't engage in a party in the beginning, because this is always the beginning somewhere. And that changed. I think the format changed a little bit. You're looking a little bit more what can be more attractive for a woman. Also the timetable, maybe. And also I think that the parties, they are more aware that they have to push women. So they, when you have places to get or people to get for positions, women are more in the focus, but not enough, still not enough.
You're saying that about Germany and you've had Angela Merkel, and I'm just like, wow, if that's not enough, like look at us in Bhutan, right, Amphan Sok? Like you've been one of the most passionate voices trying to get women particularly into positions of leadership, and why should they even aspire to positions of leadership? I mean, the democratic process in Bhutan is now, what, 15 years? Yes. So for you, what has your experience been like? What made you decide that you wanted to work with women in the grassroots, put them in local government, and the CSO, which you closed down, which I'm very sad about, but Bhutan Network for Empowering Women, did incredible work. How did it start for you?
Actually, I think to begin with, I guess early in my journey with the whole thing with gender and development, I think it was the regular standard stuff field which you were doing for mainstreaming gender in all areas of development and governance and all that stuff. But then at a certain moment, especially after the start of democracy in Bhutan, then I observed, especially after the first parliamentary elections in 2008 and then followed by the local government elections of 2011, because we had the parliamentary in 2008 and then the first democratic elections in the local government in 2011. And when I saw the outcome of that and saw that women's participation was low and also the eventually the numbers of women that got elected were very low, and particularly in the local government elections, I saw a lot of potential in terms of as a civil society trying to make a difference. We can make some, we can make a contribution. Of course, in the parliamentary level, there are things we can do, but still at the end of the day, there are also parties in between. So, you know, there are, you know, mechanisms and machineries in place, so to speak. And the parties there, you know. But for local government, these are, you know, people who are women who are kind of launching themselves on their own as individuals, and they have no, you know, support from the state in terms of even campaign funds, stuff like that. So then I thought, okay, you know, at the time I was involved, initially I was thinking of like women entrepreneurship. I was more a believer in economic empowerment. But then as I observed, I saw the scope and the need actually for women political empowerment. And that's when I actually got involved in firstly facilitating a conference of all the elected women from the first elections, both parliamentary and local government. And there, the whole idea of a network was born, because all the women who were elected had come to the conference, and all of them felt that, you know, there was nobody out there who was supporting them. You know, there are other, you know, civil society organizations and government bodies that are supporting various entities in development on the development landscape. But in terms of political empowerment, there was nobody to really support the mandate. So that's when, in a way, as I always say, the Bhutan Network for Empowering Women, the civil society entity that I was leading, probably is maybe the only or actually one of the only entities that had been given the mandate by the people. You know, the women themselves felt at that conference that a networking platform would be necessary and would be very helpful for them. So that's where, I mean, I got my passion, actually got in fact deepened and got driven by this whole network. And then we started that. So we did a lot of exhaustive work when it comes to local government. And I like to believe, and I think we are always, you know, it's confirmed by the women themselves that the network did a lot and really helped them.
This is a very important point of what you're saying, Phoonsok. It's really networking. We have to learn. I think men are better in this than women. Yeah. And really, there are small things when you have a keynote that you cannot help. So why don't you ask a woman instead of a man to replace you? Or if you have a position to give to somebody, ask a woman. Right. It's simply things, but you have to do them.
Yes. Yeah. Like Sandra, you said earlier also about how earlier on, you know, how it was also in Germany. And I think to this day, I guess in majority of the black spaces, political spaces, it's very much like that, where the old boys network, the men's clubs, you know, men are free 24 hours, so they can anytime. But women are so, you know, kind of bogged down by the traditional responsibilities, the reproductive responsibilities of home and the children, the elderly, you know, so they have to do all that. So because of that, I think the timing of meetings and really networking is something that for women, it has to be facilitated by an entity like us, whereas for men, they do it very naturally, playing a game, you know, whether it is going out to a pub or, you know, playing a game of archery. Mm-hmm. I know all our women, you know, parliamentarians and the local government women who were elected did say the same thing, that for women, unless and until there is somebody who really regularly, you know, keeps an eye out and bring them together, you know, on their own, is very difficult, because, you know, they have so many things to focus on. You know, so,
and you can do this if you have your family behind you. For example, my husband, he was okay that I go to these meetings, that he is carrying or take care for the children. But if you have, let's say, a husband who is more or less traditional, it's very hard. And therefore, we have to change the formats and really think about the female empowerment in politics.
What about state support? I mean, you were saying how, when I talked about evolution of politics for women in Germany, what kind of support now exists that didn't exist before that encourages women to take on leadership positions in politics?
I think the parties are aware that something has to change, mm-hmm. that they have to become more female, and Therefore, as a liberal party, we have, for example, this empowerment program by the Friedrich Naumann Stiftung, the Friedrich Naumann Foundation, where you have a mentee, which comes. I had every year for the moment somebody who is coming to me to come with me in the meetings to have a look. How is it working? How is the political work working? And it's kind of a network base we try to create now since 2000 roundabout. Yeah, it started, I think, just before Corona. And I think it's a pretty good start, but still you have to go on to elaborate this, how you can do more. And I think it's really this kind of networking to prepare the woman that they have to get in contact with other women and then to help each other. I think it's not really natural for female neither. Yeah? There are sometimes also that kind of a jealousy. Yeah? So this is also particular. And therefore, let's say men, they are more buddies. Huh? I help you help me.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think this is something that I have to challenge. Where I have to say, okay, there are women, they can do actually actively get something to help other women. And so you always have to look, can I replace somebody or can I do something with a woman instead of a man?
That was actually one of my questions. You know, the mentoring system, do you think it's better if a woman mentors a woman? Like in your case, you had a man push you to join politics, right? So is it better for a man to, like, what is the difference? What is the advantage or the disadvantage, you know?
I think you have two different sides to look at, and you should do maybe both. How is a woman acting in politics? How is a man acting in politics? And I think it's not really that you need a woman to be mentored by, and it should be also something active. If you have the impression that you're good, that you want to be involved in politics, you could look also what is a role model for me. It can be a man as well as a woman, and then I think you can actively approach this person and ask. And let's say that there could be a no. I would guess it's 90-95% a yes to help you. I think also to be a little bit more confident in yourself to really do something.
Yeah, I guess in the end, to build on to your last word, confidence, I think in the end, it just boils down to your own level of confidence. But I think from our experience of when it comes to mentoring, you know, we were like initially we wanted to really like start a mentoring program as well. It was too early for us because we noticed that we were already trying to, you know, build role models at the same time, because unless those role models are there willing to, you know, mentor, then you can't really have a mentoring program. And initially we thought, okay, maybe we could do it with training with male leaders and stuff like that. Informal level, we did try a bit, and then we also often hear from the women themselves also about looking up to male role models, so to speak, male leaders who are very comforting, very, very kind, very, very gracious, and, you know, very supportive, and all that is there. But then what my reading into that was, then it's again, women are going into a relationship of being subordinated, you know?
Okay.
You know, because then we are giving the men more power over the women by actually once again trying to become a student of the man, no? As it is, that's there already in society, you know, that's already a predominant kind of a notion.
Maybe cultural aspect.
Yes, yes. So then I thought, okay, maybe, you know, we really, and then what we worked was in the later half of our journey, we were then trying to really work very actively, and we noticed that many of our women, for instance, like by the time they were into second elections and the third elections, we had women who had been there and then, you know, either continued to participate or some of them could not, you know, win the elections. So we had, you know, now by now we had a few role models, so to speak, you know, number of women who were experienced in this whole journey of participating in politics, what it felt to be there, you know, more than even us as an organization. We are just facilitating, trying to bring people together, trying to really reflect together and try to really be a facilitator. But we are not the doers, no? Like, for instance, between two of us, the difference is that you've been there, you know, you walk the talk, you know? Whereas me, I'm like more from the outside, trying to support and trying to facilitate and trying to find out from you what can we do and what are the challenges in society that we need could do help you in order to, you know, push you forward and push you up the, you know, ladder further. And so in that sense, yeah, so then we noticed that women who have been there are also, they've understood now the pains of being alone without help, you know. And now when they see, you know, other colleagues, younger or older, who are on the journey, they have that need to help, you know, because it's a women's inherent, again, it's an inherent quality in women to try and share what we know and want to help others, you know. So building on that helping attitude of women, then we try to really try to, you know, pair up, or even pairing up was a bit of a luxury. So we had to really do make groups. So at the moment, the sense I get from the field is that they're really supporting each other. Some of them who were there for one or two elections, who are one or two terms in local government, who are currently not elected, are really doing a lot of the background work and supporting the, you know, first time local government leaders.
I think in the Putney's context, we don't have as much competition. So I want to come to you, actually, because I think women leadership in Germany cannot be compared to women leadership in Bhutan, because we're still trying to be leaders here, as opposed to in Germany, where you're already leaders, right? I mean, even when you talk about, you're like, maybe not, maybe it isn't exactly where you want it to be. Like,
it's never enough.
But what's the leadership like in politics? Like, what is the representation of women, would you say? It's pretty good. I think that in health, it's pretty good, right? In Germany, but like in politics, what is it like?
In politics, it's a little bit mixed. It depends on the party. The left-wing parties, they have a lot more women than men. And it's more conservative your party is, the less women you have. I would say our party, the Liberal Party, is a little bit in between. 30% is still not enough, but we represent 50% of the people on Earth. So I think the representation. But in our government, the chancellor, he insisted that the government exists half-half. So we have 50% women, 50% men as ministers. And also at state secretaries. So this was, I think, a good approach and a good example, because I'm not really a friend of a quota. But this is also discussed all the time. And the Green Party, for example, they have this. Sometimes I think it might help to make a beginning, to just really to have, let's say, a base to start.
Work with, you know.
To work with it. Our party, they say, okay, it's more a question of competence. I agree, but on the other hand, there are also examples when it's not the competence, but the friendship who counts. But this is everywhere, and I will not complain, because I'm head of a committee. I'm chairwoman of the committee on housing and construction. So I cannot say that there are only men in exposed positions. But actually, and I think it's the local government where we have to do more, that you grow a movement.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you have also on a high level, more people, more women who can just fit on a position, on a exposed position. And in our parliament, I don't even know exactly. I think it's around about 40% female participants. So it's quite okay, but it's not something which is coming naturally. I think you really always have to have a look on it. Okay, let's have 50% in the government, for example, and then some parties who have their quotas. We have this self-commitment that we want to really to push, to empower women to get in positions, political positions. So, it seems to become a little bit more easier or natural, but we are not there for the moment.
What do you think is some of the, because in the police context, Amfiz also highlighted how we have these socio-cultural factors at play also in Germany. Do you have things that, you know, besides just policies and a lack of space, are there certain socio-cultural factors that sort of do not allow women to participate in politics or not aspire to join politics or become politicians? No? So it's really a matter of choice. What do you want to be? Doctor, politician, etc., right?
Exactly. And if you feel to be an engineer or constructor or whatever, there are no limits for women. It's really a question, what do I want? I think it's a big question of role modeling. Do you have a role model,
yeah,
a mother who is pushing maybe for a good position or for a job, or is she staying at home and she caring for the children and has this normal or traditional role model? I think that makes also something. My father died when I was 5 years old, and my mother, she had to work. And my father, when he was dying, he said to my mother, "You don't have to quit this job. You have to nourish your child." And therefore, she made a pretty nice career in the 70s, when it's not really natural that a woman becomes a power woman in economics. And she was export manager in a big company. She saw, or she traveled all over the world. That was a good role model for me. She was not there anymore very often, but it was not a lack for me. I was in the family, I had my friends, and I was very proud of her. And therefore, it's easier for me also with my children to say, okay, yes, I will leave for 1 week to go to Bhutan, for example, or do something else, because I know they are proud of me also, they told me. Even if I have a bad conscience from time to time, I think there are
mom guilt.
Mom guilt, yeah, everywhere. Yeah, everybody has guilt. But at the end, I for myself, I'm fine. And I think I had to do a good choice.
That's wonderful to hear. I think we can say the same about Bhutan, right? Not only is it like mom guilt, but I think the traditional idea of what a woman should be, the primary homemaker, the primary nurturer still exists, right?
When
universal
everywhere. When I put my children in the I just said that where the children are cared when they are not in school yet, when they are smaller, the kindergarten, we say that there were the mothers and said, "Oh my dear, your mother is not kind. She was not able to make a cupcake for the party, but because she's working." Huh? And I said, "This is really awful that women themselves, they are, they're coming out with something like this." And then my daughter came up to me, "Mama, they told me that you're not able to make the cake, right? So you have to deal with
it." Oh, yeah, I know, that's so difficult, right? For a woman, like a man would never hear this, right? That, "Oh, you didn't make cupcakes for your daughter because you were working," right? But a woman, but we've noticed this in Bhutan too, right? The lack of support from women for women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, before we get to that, I just to also touch very briefly on this whole importance of role models and critical mass, and then therefore the importance of also having, you know, laws and policies that really support, like, you know, reservation of seats or quota. Mm-hmm. To begin with, I think, as you also, Sandra, said earlier, initially, I think to kind of work with, I think we do need something, because especially in situations where the social, cultural, the traditional norms are so deeply embedded that it's very difficult for women to really, you know, step out and participate more freely. Like it is a matter of choice in Germany, for instance. It's not like that in the rest of South Asia, for instance.
Oh.
So I think in these cases where, because even the role models are so limited, so few, that, you know, we need, because for instance, like, okay, when women like us at home, when we are, you know, going to 9-to-5 jobs, our children see us working. So therefore, for them, our sons and daughters, it's a normal thing to see parents going to work.
Mm.
But in majority of the homes where that doesn't happen, then those role models are not there at home, because everything starts at home, you know, and then the school, and then, of course, in the community as a whole. So I think role models, because until you have, like, enough critical mass of women in leadership based on, know, whether the inspirations or due to other factors, until that critical mass, which the UN always, you know, stated is 33%, I think until that is there, I think we do need, because especially from my work of over 10, 12 years with this networking platform and working with the women who are really elected both in parliament and local government, I feel no matter how hard the women are trying, the women who manage to step forward and participate, I think it's not enough to really make up to that critical mass yet.
No.
So that's why even when we were like making our targets, we used to like set it at like 10%, 15%, you know, 20%, and like aiming for 50%, forget 50%, even 20-30% was like, wow. Can we ever do it, you know?
Mm.
So that is, I think,
So that's why I felt also that we can be there, other entities like civil society organizations and others can keep on supporting and trying to, you know, kind of prop it up a little bit to try and build capacity to mobilize and do all that. But at the end of the day, I think unless and until there is some policy, you know, mechanism like affirmative action, you know, measures in place, I think it's very difficult to sustain the impact of what we do, you know?
Yes.
And your question was?
Also, one of my questions was about state interventions, but we'll come to that. But really, but how women don't support women. And it's not just, I mean, like you're talking about the competitive factor too, right? But in Bhutan, it's not just competition. It's just, I feel like,
again, I think
there's no faith in leadership, women leadership, isn't it?
Supporting women, I would say there's a little bit of a myth around that also. And maybe to some extent, misunderstanding also. Because if you look at the number of women candidates that, let's say, political parties put forward, you know, out of the 47 constituencies, you know, if there are only women in, you know, 5 or 6 constituencies, and if in those 5 or 6 constituencies, so far, the success rate of women getting elected both in parliamentary and local government has been high. It's just a matter of putting the women out there, really getting them and putting them there. So, you know, women not supporting women is not really true in that sense. Because when the majority of the candidates who are being put forward by the parties in all the constituencies are men, you know, the women in those constituencies have no choice but to vote for the men. It's a matter of voting for a male from, you know, of the 5 parties. You know, so I think that is a little bit of a misunderstanding.
More systemic, like the system itself, than just
kind of a challenge there. But at the same time, the other subtle factor of women not supporting women can be there. That is where I think it's about very drop of confidence. I always tell in our capacity building to the women, you know, especially in our participating in elections and local government as well, I always say that it's always about not only your confidence, because it's confidence at 2 levels. Confidence of society in women, and then confidence in yourself as women as well. So I think confidence works at 2 levels. Firstly, you have to also come out there as a very confident individual, you know, who deserves to go into leadership. And then you have to kind of really send out those vibes to be a confident candidate so that you can influence the mindset of society to vote for you. But at the same time, that's the reason why our work was always at 2 levels, you know. We 2 tangents in a way. We would work on the women, that like I described earlier, but we used to also work on awareness raising, advocacy at the, you know, community level and also larger through media and other, you know, mechanisms to try and really build up change the mindset, the psyche of society to be more, to have more confidence in women leaders, to be more accepting of women leaders. Because generally in the deeply embedded mindset in society, you know, we have the gender stereotype mindset where we feel that leadership and public space is more suitable for men. Women should stay home, you know. They are much better at looking after the children and looking after the elderly and, you know, be at home. They shouldn't go out because then it's not a safe space for women. So that's how we grow up, thinking that the public space is for men and, you know, for your brother and not for you. So that's how our confidence level keeps on going down. And that's the reason why for external agencies like us need to work on boosting the confidence of women.
Yeah, this is a big point.
The confidence at both levels, you know. And because of that, when society as a whole, both men and women in society, also lack confidence in women leadership, you know, they think that leadership by men is stronger and better, and that, you know, when women come out, they are like first timers or second timers, and they are not so confident. Because for women to also have that confidence, I think society has to have confidence in them.
I think that the self confidence is really a big point. But really, when you have succeeded, when it's you was in the position where you really, let's say, got something, and then you have to start with your own yourself. Then you really have to think, what can I do to help other women? Not I'm there now, and now let's try to get the others down. it's not only everybody is doing this, at least it's a reflex to say, okay, now no enemies who can grow besides me, and therefore I'm really, when I have a meeting which I cannot attain or a keynote which I cannot help somebody at somewhere, I ask every time, or try to get a replacement by a woman. And also when you have a panel discussion or whatever, that when there are only men, I'm coming there, I'm the only woman. I said, this is not possible, this is not adequate. And the next time I will not come anymore. Or when you are looking at another panel discussion, there are only men, I will go there, I will say, this is, that's not our time. Yeah, it's completely old style. And then they don't think about it.
Yeah.
And they don't really know. And then they realize, yes, you're right. Yeah. Yeah, and
term for it now, manual.
Exactly.
So for a matter of, to be fair to, I think, our societies, both men and women, I think it's a matter also for them of, you know, having to really see women out there in action and to see whether they really serve, you know, as good leaders or not. Because I could see, like, even in our short journey with the elections at both levels, and particularly in the local elections, because we can see a progression from a very small constituency to a larger constituency, you know, to getting elected. And we can see that women who have been elected, let's say, as Thopas, you know, many of the women who are today in GUPS, they started their journey at Thopas. So when they are working so closely, because in the local government, they're so close to their homes, no? So close to the impacting the daily lives of communities. So at the local government and the Thopa level, when they have been when they were able to be very effective Thopas, then both men and women in the community can see that there's a difference. They can compare, because for last so many years, they had male leaders who were not effective. And now suddenly there's a woman who cares, who's concerned, who's there on a 9-to-5, even if she doesn't have to be 9-to-5, you know. And then thereafter, she gets elected as among me, that's the next level. And then thereafter, in the last local government elections of 2021, you know that it was really a historical thing here in Bhutan, where this, you know, we call it the GUP, which is like the mayor of the local government, you know, which was such a traditionally male-dominated. And, you know, even in the male psyche, when you think of a GUP, you think of man, you know, immediately. Mm. So in that local government position, the chair of the local government, out of 205 gyoks in Bhutan, in the last elections, we had a jump from 2 to 7, you know, which actually speaks and challenges the fact about women voting for women and not voting for women. So I think it's a matter of time, and probably, to be fair to the communities, you know, giving them a chance to assess for themselves.
And then you ask about state intervention. Right. In Germany, we don't have a law or something that says 50% woman, for example. What I learned from my colleagues from Austria yesterday, that they have a law that says that the parties, they are getting money from the state to finance themselves, not to be corrupted by somebody who's giving private. Yeah. And there is a kind of, you are getting more money when you have a quota, when you have more women. So, and this is, I think, it's quite of nice.
Yeah. Which you've been pushing for. In your last opinion piece, you actually wrote that we should have something like this in Bhutan. Yeah. We also don't have, you know, there's no lower, a standard. You know, minimum, like the political parties this year that are contesting in the elections, it's just man after man after man. I think I'm very surprised with the Bhutan women. Then like, oh, how nice. Which is so sad, because we're now in 2023. We're in the fourth round of elections and a political part. But again, we also have these, like we're saying, you know, in Bhutan, we also have this, I won't say a misconception, but it seems to be this, women seem to think that politics, it's a difficult job. I don't want to use the word dirty, like politics are dirty. No, but difficult. Like you are there so much in the public, you face a lot of criticism. And because you're such a small society in Bhutan, I mean, you know how it's so dirty online. People want to attack you personally. They want to attack your family.
You know?
There's a lot of women.
But even in a big society, we also have this in Asia.
Then maybe you could give some advice on how you deal with it. Like, you know, this is part and parcel of the job, but what is the high point, right? Like, why are you a politician? Like, why? Like, this is your message to women in Bhutan and women who are watching this. Why should they aspire to become a politician then?
I was inspired because I want to change something. I was always critical towards a couple of things in society, in politics. And then I was one day where I said, okay, when you want to change something, you have to be engaged. And you have to create something. And that was for me the starting point. And but what you have to know also when you start in politics, but even in other things, I think you have to learn that it's not a sprint. You cannot do this in 100 meters. It's a marathon. and you have really to be resilient to attacks. There are a lot of things where you say, why are you doing this? You are attacked from the outside. The society, they are posting in the social media things you don't really want to read. In the politics, you have this battle against men and women. There are also political things which are not very nice from time to time. And then you say, why are you doing that? Yeah, yes, because I want to change something. And I think this is really the biggest trigger you have to be engaged in as a politician. And what you have to do when it becomes, I think the higher you are in the level, it starts on the local government level already when you're mayor of a city or whatever, your family is attacked or insulted or whatever, you have to try to get somehow your family out of this. So I rarely do a post on social media with my family, the children, never with the faces, just to keep them out, because the Liberal Party in Germany, where in between 5% and 10%, it's not a majority of the society. And so you can imagine when you're in a room with 10 people, there's only one who thinks that you are really crazy. And then, my children at school also they face verbal attacks or treatments a little bit more around them. Sometimes not nice, but it's not violent. It's the subconscious a little bit, and this you have to dare, and really to be strong also in your family. I think when the family is not working together and holding together, it will be a problem. And so I think whatever you want to do, when you want to get launched in politics, first of all, you have to speak with your family. If they are supporting you, if they are behind you, because if you have said, always, I have a battle outside with the politics, I don't need a battle at home. Yeah, and therefore, this is really something which has to be cleared before.
I think I'll let you have the final say before we wrap up the podcast. Like, what are your impressions? And I'm sure you were comparing your German experience to Putin's experience. What are your thoughts now?
But actually, I have the impression that you're very organized facing this problem.
I don't even need to know.
I really say this honestly, because I don't have the impression that it worked like this in Germany. It was more or less, I don't know, it's coming up, and then okay, we have maybe a little bit more time behind us. But even if I look at my proper party, we have this empowerment program, which is very good, very nice. But to say okay, we try to organize the female groups on local government level, and to try to really give them a hand and do courses and whatever. We didn't have this, and at least we even had a reason, or we got a success without all this. So I think that you will have a very big success, and maybe you will end up even with 60% of women in the government.
We should be in touch with our MPs who are meeting today, so that we can continue long distance mentorship and support. Thank you so much for this conversation today. It was wonderful to listen to the two of you talk and then to exchange your experiences. For me, it's always something that I learn. Thank you so much. And this podcast is coming out before our elections. I'm hoping that the political parties or some politicians will listen to this and be inspired to even have last-minute female candidates. I think it will make me consider your party a little more favorably. But thank you, Friedrich Naumann Foundation, for making this conversation possible. Thank you for listening to Hello from Bhutan.